Dean. Kathleen Stevenson is also, of course, the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or WilkinCPAS.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we go to our main interview this morning, we're going to spend a few minutes hearing a report from Eastern Oregon, where protesters spent last night trying to blockade a megaload of massive machinery being shipped from the port of Umatilla to the tar sands operations in northern Alberta. We have Michael Caskill of Portland Rising Tide on the phone to tell us why people have organized to stop these loads from leaving Oregon. Good morning, Michael. Hi, Michael, are you there?
Good morning, Barbara. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. So before we talk about exactly what happened last night, what are these huge loads that are being offloaded from the port of Umatilla part of? What is the purpose of these loads, and why are you so intent on stopping them?
Sure. Well, so right now in the port of Umatilla sit three gigantic, they call them water purifiers in an attempt to kind of make the process or to make the equipment seem a little more innocuous. But to be clear, these aren't water purifiers for drinking water. These are water purifiers which allow them to extract oil from water in the tar sands up in Alberta, Canada, which is, according to folks who are a lot smarter than myself, the most destructive project on Earth right now. So there are, like I say, three pieces of equipment. We call them mega loads, and there's a good reason for that. They weigh over 900,000 pounds, and the load that we successfully blocked last night from leaving the port is over 380 feet long, and it has to be led and followed by a whole squadron of trucks and people lifting up power lines and doing all manner of things.
Now, a couple of years ago, we were following the story of these mega loads that were being offloaded at Lewiston, Idaho, and shipped across Idaho and Montana to the tar sands. And actually, none of them made it. There was a test module that went as far as Lolo Pass, and it got stopped partly by logistics and partly by Montana not allowing it to cross the border. Are these the same basic idea? These are huge loads that are, for some reason, not able to travel across Canada, but have to come through the United States to get to the tar sands?
Yeah. So what happened is, and I'm not entirely clear on why these are not being shipped through Canada. There's speculation that it's because of the power of the First Nations peoples and their resistance to all of these destructive fossil fuel projects. So they've been trying to find the least circuitous route that they can to get it from BC, Vancouver, BC, where these components are manufactured, up to northern Alberta. And after a couple of years of tireless activism, the members of the Nez Perce tribe, along with Idaho activists, were able to successfully get an injunction against these loads, which leads us to where we are today, which is Omega Morgan, our very own from Hillsborough.
Who moved the Selwood Bridge, I might add.
That moved the Selwood Bridge, and we thought they were all so cool. Turns out they don't have such a good reputation anymore. And so they've been scouting out every possible route. The thing is, these things are so big that they don't fit under highway overpasses, and they block traffic to an extent that they can't travel on freeways, so they have to take them on these very dangerous, windy back roads. In fact, right now, by their own admission, they're racing against the clock to get these loads out, or even one of them out, before they're blocked by, not us, but a far greater force, weather, winter weather in eastern Oregon. We frankly don't think they're going to make it.
So you're going to be back out there tonight trying to stop them again?
We'll be back out there tonight. I don't know if folks are going to be taking the same actions as last night, which I'd like to get into.
Yeah, let's do this really briefly. How did you stop them last night?
We're definitely going to be back there. And I just want to point out, if I can give you a rundown of what did happen last night.
Go right ahead.
So about, I would say, 50, 60 activists from all around the Northwest, from Idaho, Spokane, Portland, Eugene, gathered and joined with about, I would say, I'm pretty bad with crowd numbers, but I'd say a dozen to 20 tribal members from the Umatilla tribe, and to blockade this load from going out. And long story short is we successfully stopped the load from moving for an entire night, which is something that activists have not successfully done thus far in this struggle. And we had, in addition to those numbers, we had two brave folks lock themselves with metal lock boxes to respectively the front axle of the lead truck and a side piece of equipment to the truck. So it took the cops several hours to cut them out of there. And meanwhile, we were chanting the folks from Umatilla saying some really amazing and inspiring prayer songs and gave some talks. And by the time that the police were able to cut the two out of the lockboxes, it was too late for them to move because their permits, they have very tight windows that they can move these things.
Well, Michael, I'm actually looking forward to hearing more about this, so maybe we can check in again next week. We can do another report when hopefully we'll know whether you were able to stop the loads from getting out before the snow arrives tomorrow. And we'll keep posted about this.
I'd love to, and if I could real quick, if folks want to find out more, they can check out portlandrisingtide.org or on our Facebook. I don't do the Facebook, so I don't know how you do that, but I imagine most people do. So
if you just go to Facebook, actually, if you go to Facebook and you just type in Portland Rising Tide, you'll get to the Portland Rising Tide page. And there's an event happening this Thursday, I understand. There's going to be a planning meeting.
We're having an open planning meeting this Thursday at Laughing Horse Books, which is on East 10th and Burnside. And that's going to start at 6:45. And we're going to look at the next steps, because there are two more loads that are sitting in the Port of Umatilla right now and have dates that they are trying to get them out by. So if you can join us this Thursday and keep up to date, on Portland Raise the Tide's website, and we're going to be out there again tonight, and we hope that folks will continue to get involved, because it's really exciting to be able to stop these things in our backyard.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, Michael. I'm looking forward to hearing the audio you recorded, and we'll probably talk again next week.
All right. Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks a lot. We've been talking with Michael Gaskell, who's with Portland Rising Tide, about the efforts to stop the megaloads of equipment that are leaving the Port of Umatilla on its way to the tar sands in northern Alberta. In 2 weeks, we'll be talking a lot more about this, and we'll have Kevin Lewis from Idaho Rivers United on. So this is a subject we will be following closely. Now we're going to turn to the trees in paradise. California's treescape is largely a dreamscape defined mostly by non-native trees, which settlers planted to, what they say, improve what they saw as barren, brown, treeless country. The principal native trees, coastal redwoods and sequoias, were valued primarily as timber to build the infrastructure that fueled California's ferocious dreams of growth. As native trees were cut down in a frenzy, Californians thought they could replace the redwoods with fast-growing Australian eucalyptus, which along with palms and orange trees came to represent what's intrinsically Californian. But in time, each of these trees of dreams proved to contain the seeds of nightmares as well. This morning, we talk with Jared Farmer, whose new book, Trees in Paradise, explores the connections between the transplanted people and trees that have shaped the landscapes and cultures of California. Jared, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really actually very been looking forward to talking to you because I really enjoyed your book and I've been talking about it with everybody I know. And I'm not exactly sure what fascinates me so much besides the fact that I'm fascinated by trees and I'm also fascinated by the artificiality of California. So how do you bring those two things together in your book?
Well, I think California is a unique treescape, maybe in the whole world. If you think about it, I mean, California has the oldest, the tallest, the biggest tree in the whole world. It's the only place in the whole world you get three national parks dedicated to megaflora. You got redwood, sequoia, and Joshua tree. In terms of the economy, it has by far the most important tree crops. It has a virtual monopoly in all of these Mediterranean nut crops. Almonds are the number one crop in America right now. The pollination event, you may have heard Michael Pollan talk about this, for almonds in the Central Valley each spring is so incredible. They ship in bees from Australia. And I think no other state has promoted itself with trees the way California has. I mean, Florida is a distant second, but if you think about, you know, for decades, this whole kind of real estate and tourism promotion machine was built around palm trees and orange trees under snow-capped mountains, and just this idea of the California dream is really wrapped up in this horticultural dream. And so those are all the reasons why I kind of focused on California. And you're right, this landscape, for the most part, is completely artificial, but then you have this kind of incredible native landscape with sequoias and redwoods, these totemic trees, really kind of like the ultimate trees on the planet. So, yeah, I think California is just this amazing place where you have, you know, tree huggers, but also tree planters and tree fellers who encountered really the greatest trees on Earth, but also manufactured or just created this huge landscape revolution and planted trees by the billions, and it's sort of exploring both of these. It's kind of like the two sides of the American, I don't want to say like mythic tradition with like Paul Bunyan on the one side and then Johnny Appleseed. You sort of see this in California just on this incredible titanic scale. You know, people finding the biggest trees in the world and cutting them down, but also planting these horticultural trees like there was no tomorrow, and just completely transforming the landscape of lowland California.
Well, besides maybe Australia, I'm trying to think of another place where people were so dissatisfied with the native landscape that they thought that they could really improve it. And in Australia, there just were disastrous results in what they tried to do there. But let's talk about sort of the irony, I guess, of finding the most amazing trees, some of the most amazing trees on the planet, the redwoods and sequoias, and seeing them basically as timber, but then deciding that the rest of the state was too dry and barren and treeless, and the state would be that much more valuable if it was planted with all these trees that they import from all around the world. So what does that say to you about the mentality of California and maybe the rest of America for that matter?
Well, yeah, I think California, just America, you know, but more so, there is this pretty strong continuity from the gold rush to the present of just extracting gold from the land and whatever form, sometimes literal gold, sometimes virtual. That's, I suppose, like a depressing maybe continuity, but there is a kind of a yin and yang to this because, yeah, it is true that, you know, Americans, you know, found sequoias. I mean, of course, lots of people knew about them before, you know, indigenous and otherwise, but, you know, it was effectively discovered in the 1850s, and within months, the discovery tree, which they call the capital D discovery tree, was cut down, you know, just for the hell of it, which is such an American act. But there were plenty of Americans who immediately, you know, decried that, said this is a horrible example of vandalism, and people did think about, you know, protecting these trees from the very beginning. And indeed, you know, by the late 19th century, many of the sequoia groves are protected, and by the mid-20th century, basically all of them are, sometimes with a lot of pressure from Europeans who were horrified, who said that we would never do this. What's wrong with you Americans? And there were plenty of Germans and English who actually planted sequoias, anticipating that Americans would just make this tree go extinct. But there were lots and lots of Californians who were horrified by this. And my book is actually largely about this kind of post-Gold Rush generation that looked at the kind of greed and the avarice of the Gold Rush and this kind of mining trees and wanted to kind of fix that. But their way of fixing is very different than the way environmentalists would today, because basically they wanted just to plant more trees, not necessarily native ones, and they would be happy to replace redwoods with eucalypts if that worked, and brought in trees from all over the world. So it was a little different sensibility. But
well, let's talk a little bit about that whole concept of replacing the redwoods. And I guess it wasn't just the redwoods, but also the oaks, which you don't go into. It's a sort of a side point, but why don't you mention the oaks in this book in the same way that you talk about the redwoods?
Yeah, there was some hard choices about which trees to leave out. Ultimately, I decided I'd do four types of trees, and I chose, you know, redwoods, sequoias as one, then oaks, then eucalypts, then citrus, then palms. It's already a big book. Oaks is the obvious, like, omission, and I guess I didn't include it because I decided I could do what I wanted to do with oaks with eucalypts, and it's just a more interesting story, because basically I use each tree type to explore a different theme or idea in California history. And with eucalyptus trees, the idea is nativeness, non-nativeness, belongingness, and, you know, oak trees that would allow me to do that too, because I think they are sort of the quintessential indigenous tree, and they have such a rich history with indigenous peoples, with acorns. But I think to talk about both would be somewhat redundant.
Well, your book could have been another 100 pages long. I was so read it. But I was actually, I had an ecologist on my show last week. We were talking about non-native species and the whole struggle to deal with invasive species in natural areas, particularly in the cities. And he's from the Bay Area, and I was mentioning your book. And he was shocked that you didn't mention or didn't focus on the oaks, because I guess that is an example of how strongly Californians identify with oaks.
But you sort of fill the same niche as oaks. And in many places, Californians after the 1850s planted eucs where they had systematically just eradicated oaks, mostly for firewood and building material.
Well, that's an interesting point, because that's kind of where I want to go with both with the redwoods and the oaks. They eradicated them almost like thoughtlessly and then thought they could replace them with the eucalyptus. And I want to talk a little bit about what they were thinking and how disastrous in a way that thought plan was.
Well, it was, I think, both a success and maybe a long-term disaster. If you think about it, most Californians arriving after the Gold Rush immediately came to Sacramento, San Francisco, and sort of spread out from there. So it's this lowland California, which actually did not have that many trees, which I think surprises a lot of people today. If you think of the Great Central Valley, it didn't have a lot of trees except for the foothills, which has beautiful oaks, still does. But to a lot of Americans, it seemed like a bipolar wasteland, because it was a desert that flooded every year. But it's so big that you'd have a lake, the old Tulare Lake, that was bigger than Lake Tahoe in surface area, which is an incredibly rich, you know, ecosystem for amphibians and fish and waterfowl and you name it. But, you know, Americans systematically drained that. So then, in a sense, you know, by creating this horticultural landscape, they destroyed this kind of wetland environment. But, you know, if you get 500,000 people showing up in a few years, they're going to use a lot of wood for building, for fire. And California, importantly, didn't have coal. Unlike Oregon and Washington had actually much better coal reserves. Not great, but much better than California. And so just for fuel, Californians needed trees. And they were kind of used to using wood in an unthrifty way, coming from the American East, where Americans were just so profligate. So it's both a combination of just this kind of rapid, monstrous growth of California and just people needed resources so quickly, and the economy couldn't grow in this sort of organic way that was more sustainable, and this kind of American mentality during the Gold Rush to just not think about tomorrow. So this post-Gold Rush generation I talk about, these improvers, these horticulturalists, people who practiced what they call tree culture, which was an earlier form of environmentalism before we called it environmentalism, they wanted to basically replace the native trees that had been cut down. And the reason they went to eucalyptus trees instead of, say, trying to cultivate native trees, well, for one thing, they didn't have this preference for native plants that we might today. That wasn't part of their thinking. They just wanted more trees, period. And in fact, they sort of thought they could make California better. There wasn't this notion that, you know, these are endemic species in a native ecosystem, we need to preserve that. That wasn't the notion at all. But they were environmentalists in the sense they cared about sustainability, didn't use that word, but they did, and health and beauty. And they chose eucalyptus trees because this was the fastest growing hardwood in the world. It just grew basically to sequoia-like size in 50 years in California. Just amazing. I mean, you can understand why not just Californians, but the British Empire, the French Empire, all sorts of imperial projects in the 19th century brought in eucalyptus trees to change environments because it just grew so well, especially because there were no pests or diseases or fungi or koalas in California. I mean, this wouldn't happen today because of globalization. There are actually lots of insects now from Australia and California, too. But for this about 100-year period, these trees actually were in paradise because basically these are Australian trees in this completely disease-free, pest-free environment that's a lot like Australia in terms of climate but doesn't have all these things that evolved with it. So these trees just grew like crazy. And actually, Australians who came to California, say in 1900, or for some of the big world's fairs after the Panama Canal, were astounded. They said, these can't be eucalyptus trees. Like, we know what eucalyptus trees look like. They don't look like this. Back in Australia, they're kind of scraggly, and they're covered with, you know, sap oozing from, you know, insect wounds, and there's all sorts of, you know, koalas and birds eating it. In California, again, like a sequoia-sized hardwood tree growing in 50 years. So that's why people brought them in, and they thought they were beautiful, and they thought they could improve the climate and solve malaria. They had all these kind of grand notions of how they would improve. But you can understand why if they had a choice between, like, planting California acorns and waiting 200 years to get a little tree or planting eucalyptus and getting a sequoia-sized tree in, you know, 20, 30, 50 years, like, from their point of view, it was kind of a no-brainer to use eucalyptus trees.
It actually kind of reminds me when I was planting my garden 20 years ago, and it was just kind of a very small, barren landscape. And so I put in Buddleia and Viburnum because I have fast-growing trees. Well, they're all gone now. I took them all out. And my second generation of planting was trees that were maybe some of them are native, some of them are not native, but much closer to what would be a native species. And they're slower growing, but much more beautiful, and also
A lot of Californians came to regret these trees because they grew too big, and then they took too much water, or they buckled sidewalks, or they overshadowed houses, or you know, there were these waves of enchantment and disenchantment with eucalyptus trees. It really is a great story of dreamers and schemers, and there was this huge speculative boom in eucalyptus real estate in the early 20th century that crashed 100 years ago, and but eventually California sort of learned to love eucalyptus trees sort of as this blooper, like, oh yeah, all these people in the century thought they would make California better. Maybe they didn't, but we sort of came to like these trees, and they smell like home, and they make us feel at home. And I think a lot of Californians who had sort of shallow roots, who weren't from there, who weren't, you know, indigenous in the sort of literal sense, sort of took comfort in this idea that these are trees that aren't from here as well, but they sort of grew and took root, and now they're landmarks in the landscape, and you know what I mean? They sort of, I think, have an affinity for that. So in the mid-20th century, there was widespread love for these trees, but then you go to the late 20th century, and there's a huge reversal in public attitudes, and many, many Californians now actually hate them, and many environmentalists call for their removal. But you have this kind of small but very vocal group of eucalyptophiles who will call themselves environmentalists too, but are fighting against the other environmentalists over these kind of legacy plantings from the 19th century. In San Francisco and Berkeley right now, there's some battles. This has been going on for a couple decades now.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking this morning on Locus Focus with Jared Farmer, who's written a book called Trees in Paradise about four iconic tree species in California, which really have defined the culture, starting with the redwoods and sequoias, but also the three most principal non-native species, eucalyptus, citrus, and palm, which we're going to get into the rest of these now. I like sort of to look at eucalyptus. Well, actually, let's look at all four species of trees you talk about in terms of the culture wars and the environmental wars that pitted communities against each other. And the one that I think most people outside of California are most familiar with are the timber wars in Northern California over saving the coastal redwoods. If I want to talk about that, we'll start there and then talk about the other struggles. You mentioned a little bit about the battles around the eucalyptus, and then certainly there have been also battles around citrus and palms as well. But let's start with a very brief synopsis of the 1980s timber wars in Humboldt and in Mendocino County.
Yeah, so the 80s, 90s into the early 2000s was really like part three, if you want to think of that way, of a century-long struggle to protect the remaining, we would now call them like old growth or primary growth, redwood, coast redwood in Northern California. So the first phase was in like the teens, 20s, 30s, and that was mostly the Save the Redwoods League. And this is mostly like rich, powerful white men, businessmen, basically paying cash to other rich, white, powerful businessmen. They were often friends who owned the land, and then those men basically deeded the land to California for the state park system, which was very successful. Sort of like the Nature Conservancy, you could say, has been very successful taking corporate money and saving land, and you know, you can criticize that, but they're very good at what they do. And the Save the Redwoods League was very good at what they did, even though these men were often, you know, nativists and even eugenicists and sometimes had noxious politics, but did save a lot of trees. The second part of the battle was in like the 1960s, 70s, which was over Redwood National Parks, establishing it and later expanding it. And the Sierra Club was, there were many groups, but that was the most prominent one. And that fight was in Congress. That was legislation to basically, the term is legislative taking, which is a little bit like eminent domain. It's sort of like the government takes private land, but then agrees to pay for it at market value later on. That was very, very controversial and sort of set up the third battle, which is the one you're talking about in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, which was more about grassroots activists, many based in Northern California, but many coming from other states. People like Judy Berry will be well known to your listeners. Of course, Julia Butterfly Hill, but many, many others that perhaps deserve to be as famous or more famous. And there was one group, the Environmental Protection Information Center in Mendocino County, EPIC, that basically filed lawsuits. So really this was about grassroots activists filing lawsuits and other activists doing direct action, sort of sometimes in a coordinated fashion, sometimes not, as a way to sort of stall logging on private property, mostly Pacific Lumber, but also trying to force government, state and federal, to sort of pay Pacific Lumber to obtain what ended up being like one big grove that became the focus of this, the Headwaters Grove in Humboldt County. And I mean, I could go on, but that's kind of like the three stages of this century-long battle. And each one got more and more divisive than the last, and people were fighting over smaller and smaller pieces as it went on. But, you know, if you want to hear more, I can. But
I think we've probably heard a lot less about palms and citruses on this station than we have about the redwoods. But from reading your book, you got the feeling that at least the timber people felt like the environmentalists won the last round, and that in fact they maybe have won forever. And I wonder if that's an accurate understanding of where things stand now with the redwoods in Northern California.
Well, I mean, there still is redwood logging in California, but it'll never be big business again. But that would have happened with or without these activists, probably, because, you know, once the really big old timber is gone, it's gone. I mean, you can have sustainable redwood logging, and I think you're going to start to see this in the 20th century. It is possible, actually, to, you know, grow redwoods on a 50, 80-year rotation and to do it well. But the really, really valuable, you know, fine-grained ancient trees, you know, once it's gone, or once it's protected, and basically that's been settled now in the early 21st century. Basically, all of the remaining old growth is now in public hands. It's a tiny fraction of what it used to. So the kind of big-scale logging is gone, but that would have left anyway. Basically, these companies were pulling out anyway, and in many, they were not the friends of the working-class loggers. they were pulling up and going to, you know, Indonesia or Mexico or other places where there are fewer environmental and worker safety regulations. So and you see this in Oregon and Washington.
Yeah, we had the same story here.
Yeah.
Blame it on the spotted owl, but it was really a combination of exporting logs to Asia and then just exporting the forest basically overseas as well.
Yeah, but there's a couple of like interesting experiments now in Mendocino County where you have like second growth land that was just completely mined in the early 20th century, but now you have kind of private kind of land stewardship organizations who want to create working forests that are more sustainable, that work as habitat, but also can sustain themselves financially through a little bit of logging. And I think there's some kind of hopeful signs that you could have kind of a niche redwood industry, again, on a very different scale, but to truly be sustainable. And I think that may happen here in the 21st century.
Well, I want to move on to citrus, which was, for me, a tree I knew the least about of the book, the trees that you mentioned. And what I found, both the citrus and the palms have this thing about being kind of stylish, that the citrus were also not just stylish, but also like very capitalistic. So I want to talk a little bit about the economic underpinnings of the citrus industry, and then talk about some of the environmental issues that arose that caused it to be a little more controversial than maybe a lot of us who drink California orange juice might realize.
Yeah. So I talk about in the book this term horticapitalism, which is sort of like a tarnished version of this tree culture movement I've been talking about, of these reformers, these improvers who thought a lot about these environmental ideas. At some point, when especially with citrus, that vision narrows and it just becomes about making money from trees. You know, and there was a specific kind of citrus, an orange, a Washington navel orange, it's called. It was literally the money tree, and it's been kept alive. You can go to Riverside and see it. There were actually two of them, and one was replanted ceremonially by Teddy Roosevelt, and another one is still kept alive. It's basically a variety of navel orange that has no seeds, that's very sweet, that has a nice thick kind of albedo, or the white kind of cushion, and then a beautiful orange peel. Because the reason why California oranges have always been really valuable is not that they taste better than, you know, oranges from Brazil or Florida or someplace else. It's that they are spotless and beautiful and flawless and bright orange on the outside. It's all about surface beauty. And it has to do with these shifts in temperature between day and night you get in California, you don't get in other places, because the trees grow on these kind of thermal belts in the foothills. So that's why the tree became so powerful as an economic engine. But it took so much experimentation and large-scale worker exploitation and poisons and winter heating. Basically, they would burn crude oil in buckets. And just foul the air.
In barrels.
So you couldn't even see the mountains from L.A. It was like really intensive operation to make these beautiful oranges. And then it took tons of advertising. You had, you know, this very famous, like textbook famous, advertising campaign by Sunkist in the early 20th century with, you know, trains going to the Midwest and the East in the wintertime, you know, big lit-up signs in Coney Island and Times Square and giving away recipe books to housewives and things like that. So just an incredibly intensive capitalist enterprise, and it's really tied with oil, you know, not just burning the crude oil, but oftentimes like these companies are just hand in hand, and many times you have oil derricks right above orange trees growing in Southern California in the early 20th century. And these are really the two industries that push California to kind of global prominence. Because gold, I mean, it was incredibly important in kickstarting California, but it sort of came and it went. But then citrus and petroleum were these industries that brought capital to California instead of sending capital outward. I mean, most of the gold left, right? People came, they got rich, and they went back to New York or wherever. Whereas citrus and oil, these are Californians making money in California, keeping that money in California. So before there was aerospace, before there was Hollywood, it was really those two trees. So even though you can say this was an incredibly, again, worker exploitative and environmentally damaging economic activity. It did a lot for the economy, and there was a lot of kind of nostalgia for this kind of era that I'm a little suspicious of. But you can understand there was this kind of beauty to these citrus colonies underneath the mountains. And these towns were, I mean, they were kind of incredible, like a Redlands or Riverside or Ontario. I mean, they had like fountains and statues of Roman goddesses and opera houses. There really is nothing like that in America today. I mean, you'd have to go to like Napa Valley, I think. So basically today, if you're a billionaire in California and you want to dabble in agriculture, you're going to buy a vineyard, right? Maybe in Sonoma, maybe you cut down some redwood trees and put in some Pinot Noir. But back in the day, if you were like a copper magnate or a robber baron, you would go to like Redlands or Riverside and buy a little like grove of oranges as like your hobby as a billionaire. Today, I mean, citrus still exists in California in a big way, but it's all in the Central Valley. It's been moved completely from Southern California. There's not a single orange grove in Orange County. And it's completely devoid of romance now. It's just pure horticapitalism. It's you know, it's undocumented Mexican workers living in, you know, shanty towns. But it's still an incredibly valuable crop because it's beautiful. It's the table orange. I mean, most of the orange juice you drink actually is going to come from Florida or Brazil because it doesn't matter what the fruit looks like because you never see the fruit. But in California, the industry might actually transform or even die because there is a disease that is transported by an insect that has already devastated Florida in the last few years, and it's coming to California. So in the next 10 years, we might see large-scale global changes in the citrus market. So this is not a stable industry. It's already moved once completely from Southern California to the Central Valley, and now there's big changes afoot again.
Well, one of the things that struck me is that the orange trees, unlike the eucalyptus trees, are not really well acclimated to the climate that they were being grown in.
No.
And the smudging, I was talking with some friends, and none of us had realized the smudge pots, what they really were, and just how polluting, and that they weren't these little cute pots, but like 55-gallon oil drums.
Today, people will collect them and bronze them and put them on their patio. Yeah, that's a great point. This is basically a tropical tree. It's native to Southeast Asia. So, I mean, to grow in California, I mean, not just the smudging in the winter, but you need water. So, I mean, this is water coming from, you know, dams. It's coming from canals. If you think about horticulture in California, all these millions and billions of trees, it's all because of things like the Central California Project, all these dams and canals. If you fly over the Central Valley, you look down, and there's no wetlands, but there's like these ribbons of concrete where all of the water from the Central Valley is being moved from place to place, usually from the north to the south.
Well, this is so California Aqueduct, the great river of California.
Yeah. Right, so it's completely dependent on this kind of artificial waterwork system that's, you know, quite vulnerable to climate change. It's vulnerable to ocean sea level rising. It's vulnerable to earthquakes. So it's beautiful as these landscapes are, yeah, they're not innocent, and they're certainly not permanent.
Well, in the last few moments, I want to talk about the most artificial of all California trees, which is the palm.
Yeah.
And that one I found fascinating, thinking of it in terms of it really being a fashion statement. So let's talk a little bit, because I guess just a little bit backing up, but when I first came to California and I, you know, saw eucalyptus and palms for the first time, and I had no idea that neither one of them didn't grow natively in California. And I learned early that the palms in San Francisco were all obviously introduced, but then I learned about the eucalyptus and how they had been introduced as well. But then when I went down to Southern California and learned that all those palms were also artificial, so to speak, it made me really rethink, you know, what this image of California is. So how does the palm play into California kind of inventing and reinventing and reinventing itself?
Yeah, so I'll point out there is one species of palm native to the state of California. It's the California fan palms. So if you go down to Palm Springs, not in town, but if you go up to Palm Canyon, the Indian Reservation, Palm Canyon, and other canyon oases in the Sonoran Desert on the California side, that is a native palm tree. But there were no palm trees in the LA Basin, you know, or anywhere northward of Palm Springs in California. They were all brought in. And initially, they actually weren't a big part of the promotion or the image of Southern California. I think that surprises us today. If you went to California in, say, 1900, you would be struck maybe by the lack of sidewalk trees in L.A., but if you, to the extent you saw them, you see acacias and eucalyptus trees, but especially pepper trees, which is a kind of sumac. That was the tree that everybody talked about. And now they're quite hard to see in L.A. So it's really not until kind of like the Depression era that you get large-scale sidewalk plantings when the city of L.A. is kind of looking for a cheap way to ornament all these new auto roads that they're just creating on a grid. And then sort of simultaneously, you have the Hollywood industry that then starts linking palm trees with glamour and glitz and sex. And so it's these things sort of grow up together in the mid-20th century as L.A. becomes like the most photographed and the most filmed city in the world. And so you get this, and these trees that started out as just little tiny, you know, sticks with little tufts on top became some of the tallest palms in the world. And it's really, I think it's sort of the mid to late 20th century, you get this linkage of like L.A. equals palm tree, but also palm trees equal a kind of L.A. glamour. And some, and people will also read that as, you know, phoniness or fakery or whatever, plasticness. But that's actually a big change from, you know, say 1900.
But it seems like the eucalyptus, palm trees have their defenders and their detractors, and that there are people that have been trying to get rid of the palms in the same way people have been trying to get rid of the eucalyptus.
Yeah, not so much get rid of, but not replace. And then there's a couple issues. Like one is, like eucalyptus trees, a lot of these pioneer-era palm trees are getting sick and dying, often because of fungus, but also insects that have been introduced. But the second issue is that palm trees don't provide what today we would call like ecosystem services, or you know, things like carbon sequestration or, you know, urban heat cooling, the kind of things we want trees to do in a sort of water-wise way. So L.A. a few years ago made international news by saying they wouldn't replace these really tall fan palms when they died. And the international press totally mangled the story, and they got the city got all these calls saying, "I can't believe you're cutting down all the palm trees. How could you do that? You know, like, would Nike get rid of its swoosh? You know, like," when in fact they just said they're not going to replace them because they were concerned about sort of equity when it comes to shade. If you look at a map, a canopy map of L.A., it perfectly overlays a income map. So basically, the poor parts of the city are the parts with no trees and no shade. If you go to, you know, West Hollywood, or the, you know, other parts of the West Side, if you go to Pasadena, lots of trees, lots of shade, but other parts don't. And so there are groups like Tree People, a great organization that for a long time has been looking for, you know, sort of drought tolerant but shady trees as a way to kind of improve neighborhoods in a city that's actually quite poor when it comes to parks. There's not that many parks per capita in L.A. and not much shade. So that's one reason why I think palm trees have sort of fallen out of favor, whereas before they were just sort of thought of as a perfect infrastructure tree, as a kind of aesthetic infrastructure, because they don't have leaves and they don't have much roots, and they're just kind of sticks with these showy tops that they're a perfect complement to this automobile road landscape. But then I think today, as many Angelenos are actually thinking, like, could we make this city more friendly to pedestrians and to bikes, and is there a way that we could do infill more and actually maybe add parks, that palm trees seem just like not as good of a fit. So, but they'll still be part of this psychic landscape, and the city is committed. They've actually made this public announcement that they will keep palms on Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard, because tourists expect to find them there, and they will still find them there, because, you know.
Well, Jared, I would love to continue this conversation. I'm hoping we can maybe in a few weeks, because there's a whole lot of areas that we haven't really touched on yet. So we're out of time for now, but can we talk about this again maybe in a few weeks?
I would love to. Thanks.
I'll be in touch about making another date. So thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Take care.
We've been talking with Jared Farmer, who's author of Trees in Paradise, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. And I will get Jared back on, hopefully within another month, because there's a whole other side to the story we didn't even get into. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll be talking about nature murals with Mike Houck and Leslie Paul Kaspar. And the following week, we'll talk about more about the megalodes that are coming through Oregon, Idaho, and Montana onto the tar sands. We'll be having Kevin Lewis of Idaho Rivers United. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell.
Everybody looks so real at ease. Jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO Jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hurst University's 5 part-time MBA programs designed for adults who are seeking to enhance skills, revitalize career potential, and gain new knowledge that can be applied at work the next day. December 5th, evening information session. Details at merrillhurst.edu.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. According to today's guest, Dr. Richard Horowitz, you may not know that you have Lyme disease. Often called the great imitator, Lyme disease can mimic chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, autoimmune conditions, multiple sclerosis, even psychiatric disorders and dementia. In 2013, the CDC announced that the number of Americans diagnosed with Lyme each year is around 300,000, a number roughly 10 times higher than the previously